The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on the movie Choke, the recent Clark Gregg written and directed movie based on a novel by Chuck Palahniuk. Joining me in the studio is Dan Coyce, a contributing writer to New York Magazine. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
So let's take it away with a quick plot description of Choke. Then we have a major spoiler, which will kick off a discussion, I think a good discussion of the movie and how twists tend to work in these Palahniuk stories, right? Mm-hmm. Always a big twist at the end. Okay, so we start off in Choke with the key choker, the protagonist. What's his name? Victor Mancini.
Victor.
Played by Sam Rockwell, who has a bunch of things going on in his life at the same time. He's a sex addict enrolled in a 12-step program for sex addiction.
Unsuccessfully, right? Enrolled, it must be added, as he spends most of his time at the 12-step meetings having sex.
Right. He ducks out with the young lady he sponsors for a quick grope in the hallway. He also has two jobs. He works days at a kind of colonial theme park. It's not quite clear where this is, but it sort of seems like something, a Williamsburg, Virginia type theme park with people in faux 18th century garb.
Right. It's some kind of low rent Williamsburg that is nonetheless within reach of the Metropolitan Transit Authority's bus service.
Right. Oh, that's right. Because they are in the general New York area,
yeah.
I suppose. So that's his day job. And his sort of sideline is that he pretends to choke. This is where the title comes from. Pretends to choke in upscale restaurants in the hope that some benevolent patron will come along, perform the Heimlich maneuver, and then feel sorry for him and give him money for the rest of his life.
Right. And in fact, he actually literally does choke. There are numerous gruesome scenes of him shoving enormous wads of food down his throat.
Is the idea supposed to be that he is actually risking his own life each time he fakes choking?
Yes. We are
so they're really performing the Heimlich maneuver? He's not just spitting out the food?
Yes. We are meant to believe that he is literally choking and near death at every time, but such is his mutual desires for money and human connection that he is willing to risk that in order to be given the Heimlich maneuver by wealthy strangers.
Which pretty much points up the key element of Victor's character, which is that he's this wildly self-destructive, kind of dead-end loser guy.
Desperate for a connection with some other human being,
who,
even if he won't
admit
it.
Even in voiceover, he admits this somewhat heavy-handedly in the voiceover that it is more for the human connection that he does this choking thing.
Right.
Okay, so as the story develops, his mother, played by Angelica Houston, is kind of withering away in this old folks' home. She has dementia.
We're meant to believe that she was at one time some kind of a non-specific 60s radical who was on the run from Johnny Law for quite some time, often on the run with her son, often on the run without her son, as he was often given over to foster care. In visiting her in the hospital, he becomes obsessed with the fact that she seems not to recognize him anymore and constantly laments to Victor that her son Victor won't visit anymore, even as she believes that he is one of the various doctors and lawyers from throughout her long and checkered life. He befriends befriends who he believes to be a doctor at the institution, played by Kelly MacDonald, who tells him of a possible experimental treatment that could save his mother's mind and life from her non-specified illness, but it would require her to be pregnant with Victor's child. So then a lot of unsuccessful sex.
Right, because then Victor, the sex addict, suddenly finds himself impotent only with this one woman, this doctor. And here's where the story started to really spiral out of control for me because, well, should we just get to our twist now?
Sure. Well, there are several twists, but the big one, of course, after many, many unsuccessful attempts to have sex with Kelly MacDonald and the realization that he is, in fact, falling in love with her, it is revealed that she's actually a mentally ill patient who believes herself to be a doctor and pretends to be a doctor, but who does idolize Victor's mother and has made up a lot of stories along the way.
Right. And we could get into maybe what some of her crazy stories are. But when I say that the twist really, really didn't work for me, and first of all, this is a typically Palahniuk-type twist in that it happens almost at the end. It's about four-fifths of the way through the movie or something. There's very, very little of the movie left after we find out this major rug pull that the woman that we thought was sort of holding everything together and, you know, trying to save the mother's life is, in fact, a fellow nut on the mental ward. And I don't like the way these kind of twists work. I know that Fight Club, you know, the Palahniuk novel that was made into a David Fincher movie, is a great, great cult favorite, and people sort of love to swoon over it. But I always felt like the last third of that movie was just a complete mindfuck for the viewer, and it always made me very angry.
Well, it seemed, to my mind, I feel like a lot of people really loved Fight Club and love a lot of Chuck Palahniuk novels, in part at least because of the mindfuck aspect of it. Like, I think they hold Palahniuk up to as some kind of superior intelligence and enjoy being played by him in some respect. I think that they enjoy that aspect of the novels, whereas to me, that's the most irritating thing about his writing, and that was one of the most irritating things about Fight Club, and that certainly is the most irritating thing about the twist in this movie. Finding out that Kelly MacDonald's character is not a doctor, but is in fact a crazy patient who is just as crazy as everyone else in this crazy world does not advance the plot, and it does not reveal some sort of previously unknown aspect of the themes of this movie. It simply feels like a gotcha for no particular purpose.
Well, the worst thing about that kind of twist to me, and if you remember the twist in Fight Club, of course, was that this, you know, kind of demonic friendship that had been going on the whole time between Brad Pitt and Ed Norton was actually an internal conflict, and that Ed Norton was both people at the same time.
Right.
And, you know, rather than sort of feeling like, as you say, that something new is revealed, it feels to me that the emotional stakes have been lowered, you know, that you've been invited to care about the whole time. And that was what bugged me the most about Choke, too. I mean, we should stipulate that the movie, I think, has lots of charm, and, you know, it has individual scenes that are quite funny. It has wonderful performances by Anjelica Huston and Sam Rockwell, and they kind of managed to keep the whole thing afloat despite this basic tonal problem. But I just couldn't decide how much to care about this movie. You know, I mean, you're sort of scoffing your way along at all the absurdities. We haven't even mentioned some of the ridiculous things, like the idea that he's a half clone of Jesus Christ, Sam Rockwell's character, because his mother somehow had herself impregnated by a clone taken from the sacred foreskin or something like that.
Despite her frequent claims that he was actually born of a traveling salesman from Norway with Tourette's syndrome.
And so it's full of those kind of, like, I guess, I don't know what you'd call them exactly, but these sort of quirky, manic, sort of vaguely postmodern, you know, novelistic details. Things that are supposed to make you feel somehow displaced or held at arm's length from the narrative. Well, this is just a crazy fantasy that couldn't really happen. But as soon as the movie wants to invite you in for some emotional scene, be it, you know, the mother's death or the redemption of Sam Rockwell, the sex addict, when he falls in love with Kelly MacDonald, then suddenly you're invited to come in, wringing out your hanky, and suddenly caring about these people, and that made me feel really played.
Right, and in that way, Fight Club, for all the reasons that I sort of hated it, is in many ways a more successful movie than Choke, only because it doesn't even really ever attempt to woo you in that way. It is an object, and it's an object meant to wow you in a way that this movie isn't. This movie is really sort of desperately attempting to form a human connection, just as Victor is all the way through the movie.
It's true. It's a lot like Victor. It's a very, very needy movie. You know,
right.
It's this movie that wants everything. It wants to be laughed at, and then it wants to be entertaining, and it wants to be, you know, sort of tragic by turns. And it just expects the viewer to be dragged along in all of this without being very generous in return and giving us much to hold on to.
It wants to be deep, but it also wants to be dirty and shallow and it certainly is one of the few movies I can think of in recent memory whose climactic redemptive scene for the protagonist involves him shitting all over a police station floor.
Oh, yeah. There's some really bad gross-out humor. Should we do a couple of raunch spoilers before we wrap up? Because it is a movie largely about sex. It's actually strangely non-explicit in the sense that you don't see very much nudity at all. There aren't sort of, you know, the cut-to-something-gross kind of scenes that, you know, a Farrelly Brothers comedy, say, would try to get away with.
But it does have a lot of sort of, I guess, for lack of a better term, Polanyi Yuckian or perhaps Polanyi Yucky moments in which bodily taboos are violated in mind or in voice, at least as a way of sort of advancing the Polanyi Yucky view of the world as a world of squalor, yet also squalorous beauty. And so, you know, Sam Rockwell gets a bunch of Benoit balls stuck in his ass for the last third of the movie and eventually shits them out in an explosive cathartic moment. And there are a number of semi-gruesome sex scenes. There's Joel Grey as a sex addict talking about the tranny hooker who beat his face in.
I have to say, though, I love Joel Grey's performance in that little momentary cameo. I thought it was one of the few moments of any real emotional depth in the movie.
It definitely is all of a piece with the sort of Chuck Palahniuk style of attempting to distance us in some way with narrative tricks or with gross out humor or with scatology, but while also trying to draw us in to embrace his view of a character in need of love.
Do you think this movie has any possibility of becoming a cult hit the way that Fight Club did? I mean, it's not as big a movie and it's not as sort of obviously violent and, you know, overtly manly of a movie, but do you think it could attract the same kind of cult audience?
It feels like the kind of movie that will be gleefully watched 20 years from now by, like, stoners in college, but not the kind of movie that anyone's going to be writing Cahiers de Cinema articles about in 2020.
Even giving it a 20-year lifespan feels pretty generous.
Well, I mean, it has a lot of boobs, and it has, I mean, it has some really very funny jokes. I mean, I don't mean to shortchange the jokes in this movie, many of which are quite good. And a lot of that comes from the performance of Sam Rockwell, and that's something I'd love to talk about a little bit, which is to say, you mentioned briefly that Sam Rockwell and Anjelica Huston both give really good performances. In fact, a lot of the acting in this movie is really quite good. Even Kelly MacDonald, saddled with the most unfortunate part I can remember.
Oh, her role makes no sense whatsoever. Oh, yeah. The poor woman, none of her motivations are even vaguely credible.
In a career full of really thankless parts, this might be the most thankless of Kelly MacDonald's career. But she does very well, and everyone is really good. But Sam Rockwell really holds this movie together to the extent that I can't imagine how insufferable this movie would have been with literally anyone else in the lead role. I mean, I can't think of anyone else who could sort of pull off both the comedy and the pathos of this movie as well as Sam Rockwell does, as difficult as that is. I mean, I can't imagine anyone pulling off the scene like the one in which a woman opens the door of an airplane bathroom and Sam Rockwell is sitting there looking sad and naked. And she goes in and has sex with him. Could anyone else sad, naked, and alluring as Sam Rockwell does?
Well, we were saying just thank the Lord it wasn't Ed Norton in this role, because he would have brought the whole thing into a sort of gloomy existential realm that would not have done this movie any service.
Right. Or I could, you know, on the other side of things, I could see Jim Carrey giving one of his sad clown performances, and he's pulled it off from time to time, but I just don't think he could have pulled it off in this movie. Like, it's a very difficult balance to have. And Sam Rockwell is an actor who I think a lot of people have really loved for a long time. Certainly I've loved him for a long time, and I've always desperately wished that he would get the kind of leading role that could really break him out. And clearly, I think in taking this role, he too has thought, finally, here's a role that sort of plays to my various strengths. And if there's one thing that's going to come out of this movie, I mean, I don't think this is the great role Sam Rockwell has been looking for, but I do think it might get him the great role he's been looking for. You know, I think other directors are going to watch this movie, and as annoyed as they may be with it, they're going to see, hopefully, what Sam Rockwell can do and put him in something great.
Well, that would be one redeeming and saving grace of a movie all about redemption. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dan, for joining me on this Slate spoiler special.
Thanks very much.
For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.